Morning. Be seated, please. I want to welcome you here today. We have three cases on the docket. In case you're just on the off chance you're not familiar with our rules, we ask you to keep to the timers that are visible on your podium and are visible to us as well. We've read the briefs and record excerpts. We have not necessarily read all of the records, so you can help us out with record citations. The first case of the morning is Jackson versus Ford, number 12-50355. We'll hear from Ms. Weber.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Rebecca Weber, and I represent the appellants, who are Regina Jackson, Rudolph Williamson, and Dambra Jackson, who are respectively the mother, the father, and the older sister and a state representative of Rachel Jackson, who died at the Travis County Jail on July 21, 2008. Now, this appeal has two fundamental related issues. First, it was error for the district court to dismiss the constitutional claims on summary judgment. And second, that error affected the quality and the quantity of evidence at trial. So as to the first issue, Travis County hired an official a year before Rachel Jackson died to set up the Travis County Pharmacy. Before that time, Travis County had a contract with an outside pharmacy. So Travis County designated this official pharmacist in charge and delegated to her the final policymaking authority for Travis County pharmacy policies. As part of her role as pharmacist in charge, she wrote the county's pharmacy policy and procedures manual, and she also made the decision that pharmacists would not view warnings regarding severe drug-drug interactions, and thus jail healthcare staff, corrections staff, and the inmate patients themselves would not be informed regarding these warnings of severe drug-drug interactions. So in the case of Rachel Jackson, Dr. Ford, the psychiatrist, he wrote the script. A pharmacy tech keyed in the new prescription into the Travis County pharmacy computer system, and a warning popped up that said, action is required to reduce the risk of severe adverse interaction. And then nothing further was done. The prescription went out, it was administered to Rachel Jackson three times, and according to the Travis County's medical examiner, it stopped her heart and killed her.
Now that factual narrative is one you were able to make to the jury.
Yes. Yes, sir.
And it's not your position that the jury verdict was erroneous because of some misinstruction of law, is it? In other
no.
words, your contention is that that verdict was error because
that verdict was error regarding the evidence that the jury did see, but we also are arguing that by erroneously dismissing the summary judgment the constitutional claims, it affected the evidence that the jury saw. They saw less evidence.
How was that?
Well, under the Texas Tort Claims Act, the evidence at trial was limited to evidence regarding the misuse of tangible personal property.
Right.
So the jury never got the opportunity to see the evidence regarding other deaths in custody regarding prescriptions at the Travis County Jail.
Well, I'm not sure why that would necessarily be the case, because if it would theoretically be misuse of other property.
Well, the court can look in the record at page 2422 to 2424, where plaintiff's counsel tried to introduce two investigative files regarding other deaths in custody of inmates that have been treated by Dr. Ford, and the court ruled that those other deaths in custody were not relevant to the negligence case of Rachel Jackson herself.
Well, why would they have been relevant to deliberate indifference against Dr. Ford if they weren't relevant for negligence purposes?
They possibly would not have been relevant to Dr. Ford, but they would certainly have been relevant regarding Travis County's deliberate indifference and its custom of denying medical care, and therefore would have been.
Golly, you know, I mean, what sticks out about this is they may have given the wrong care, but they didn't deny her medical care. I mean, although at the end, obviously they weren't looking in on her every 20 minutes by any means, but she was getting someone there, a medical person, almost every day.
Well, the fact that she had nurses administering the Melaril when she shouldn't have been getting it, I don't think that shows that she was receiving medical care. She was complaining that her chest hurt and that she was unable to breathe. She was not taken to the ER. She was not given an EKG. Those facts were not relayed to, were put in her medical records so that her treating physician would know about them. So even though a nurse was coming and giving her the drug every evening.
You know what? That could happen in a hospital nowadays. I mean, I'm sorry to say it happened in custody, but maybe that means hospitals can be negligent too. But
well,
I thought the failure to give EKG evidence, and that all came out. I mean, my looking at the record doesn't show much limitation. We had warring experts here, and the medical examiner was subjected to vigorous cross, in direct examination, described the narrative you say, but then on cross seemed to be less certain as to proximate cause. So I hadn't zeroed in on your contention to us being that it's the 1983 dismissal that directly corresponds to the decision to not admit evidence. So I guess maybe you could give me those record sites again where the district court kept out the evidence and said it would have come in with the 1983?
Well, no. During trial, plaintiff's counsel tried to admit the investigative files of the other deaths
okay.
in custody.
And then the district court, what was the evidentiary ruling?
Sustained an objection regarding relevance.
Under 404B?
Regarding relevance, I believe.
Okay. And okay.
Would you like the?
Yeah, that'd be great.
It was at 2422 to 2424. When this objection was sustained regarding two of those files. But returning to the constitutional claims, even if this court doesn't agree that the pharmacist in charge had final decision-making authority regarding setting up Travis County's pharmacy policies, there is certainly evidence on summary judgment, enough to defeat summary judgment, that there was a widespread and persistent practice of denying medical care. So in addition to what we're alleging is it was an official policy of not warning the healthcare providers regarding a severe drug-drug interaction, there was also a number of other times when Rachel Jackson was denied medical care. So when she complained that her heart was racing, two nurses did not note that in her file. They did not note what her blood pressure was at the time. When she complained that she could not breathe and that her chest hurt after she had gotten the Melaril, that was never relayed to anyone. And then, most disturbingly, she was supposed to have been checked every 30 minutes. The Travis County policy said that it was they were supposed to make sure there was a living, breathing person. And she was found, in rigor mortis, hours after she died. So, what we have here is at least 13 different Travis County employees who each denied her medical care over the course of 5 days.
But as you just described on the checking, the visual log, the policy was the opposite. The policy was to check every 30 minutes.
Yes, but, I think that is further evidence that the outcome in this case was highly predictable. Why would Travis County train its employees that it's very important to alert medical when someone complains of chest pain if the outcome of not doing that were not, a highly predictable outcome that someone might have a heart attack, might die, which is what happened here. So I don't think the fact that they had policies on the books helps them, especially when those policies were not being followed. And what the official policy was that these kind of things were ignored. In addition, I think one way that I would ask the court to look at this case is the way that the Supreme Court analyzed a conditions case in Wilson v. Sider, where the court said that mutually enforcing conditions of confinement that affect a single human need can combine to create a constitutional deprivation. So, in that case, the court gave the analogy of not having heat in a prison and not giving blankets and adequate clothing. And so here what we have is a mutually enforcing condition of confinement that affected Rachel Jackson's health, her need for medical care. And that way, I think we can distinguish this case from the Piotrowski v. Houston case, where this court wasn't willing to consider all of the incidents in totality as one policy that the Houston Police Department was helping assassinate people, but rather analyzed each, broke it down into different policies, such as allowing officers to moonlight, failing to discipline, failing to criminally charge officers. Here, we have, you know, we have many instances of denying medical care, and they all combined to be this one condition of, unconstitutional condition of confinement, which was that Rachel Jackson was denied medical care over and over. Moving on to the third Monell factor, I believe the evidence on summary judgment is not equivocal regarding the moving force. There's certainly enough evidence there to show that there was a genuine dispute of material fact regarding whether or not the official policy to ignore the severe drug-drug interaction warnings and the custom of consistently and persistently denying medical care were the moving force behind Rachel Jackson's constitutional violation.
Do you know of any other case in this circuit where this court has held that a county was liable for the death of an individual in custody? I assume she's a pretrial detainee, but
yes, she was. I don't off the top of my head. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Okay.
But moving now to deliberate indifference. So the district court did cite the wrong standard. I think as this court looks at the summary judgment evidence de novo and applies the correct standard, it will see that Travis County enacted an official policy despite the obvious consequence that ignoring a severe drug-drug interaction warning and not passing that on to healthcare providers would cause an inmate to suffer a deprivation of her constitutional rights, like in this case. And there is certainly evidence in the record that the pharmacist in charge, the official who set the policy, was deliberately indifferent. She made a deliberate choice to continue a long-standing practice that had been in place with the contract pharmacy before to make that policy, Travis County's official policy, that severe drug-drug interactions would be, warnings would be ignored.
Ms. Gonzalez?
Yes, the pharmacist in charge, yes.
And when you, drug-drug interactions, of course the briefs discuss how at least at some point her testimony was that this is for level two, she would have reported level one, she didn't level two, and that's consistent with the University of Texas approach. Do you disagree with that?
No, that was the University of Texas's approach as well, but that doesn't.
So Ms. Gonzalez adopted the University of Texas approach.
Yes, a long-standing policy.
Okay.
In the county. Yes.
So a failure to report, but you also agree she did indicate that she would have reported what's called a level one.
Yes, and a level one is that it is absolutely contraindicated. A level two says action is required to reduce the risk of a severe interaction. In this case, she testified and others testified that that would have been taking the EKG and doing the serum potassium. Okay. I'm almost out of time here. I would just like to address an argument that appellees have made, arguing that the defense verdict at trial on negligence means that even if the trial court was in error, dismissing the constitutional claims, that was harmless, and I disagree for a number of reasons. First off, it's a different standard. So at summary judgment, the plaintiffs only had to show a genuine dispute of material fact. At the trial, the jury was asked to decide by a preponderance of the evidence. In addition, it's a different question. At summary judgment, there just had to be a genuine dispute regarding whether or not the policy was a moving force behind a constitutional deprivation. At trial, the jury was asked whether or not the negligence caused death. And I would assert that Rachel Jackson, if she had lived, if someone had checked on her the way that they were supposed to, she would have still had a constitutional claim. Plaintiffs didn't have to show at summary judgment that the policy caused the death. I've already discussed how there was different evidence. And with that, if there's no questions right now.
Okay, thank you. You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Kraber.
No, Mr. Walsh.
I'm sorry, Ms. Walsh.
May it please the court, David Walsh on behalf of Dr. Ford, who I didn't really hear much about other than talking about the admissibility of the cases and whether that showed deliberate.
Well, then maybe you don't need to say too much.
That's what I'm hoping. and since most of that was discussed about Travis County, I'd like to shift whatever time I have left over to them. Just a couple of things I'd like to address. One was the objection about introduction of evidence on pages 2422 to 2424 that was discussed. And that discussion is about admission of one case, some other patient named Flores, who had voluntarily stopped taking her medication, had a seizure, and apparently died. And Dr. Ford saw her in the interim and made a medical decision not to restart her medication. The trial court ruled that that was irrelevant and unduly prejudicial. One instance, it doesn't seem to prove a pattern or any serious conduct, and it's a completely different mechanism of injury than what the plaintiff is alleging here. Just because you have a drug issue in the past doesn't mean that you are fully in the future. And then the more important issue is that's the first time we've heard about this admission of evidence problem from the new trial through the briefing to now. Is the first time is now. It would seem like it's waived by not mentioning it before we got here. And they've not put an issue in that this evidence should have been admissible. And so I think that is the answer to that question, that it doesn't really, it's not really preserved for review here. Second, briefly, on the issue of whether this is a conditions of confinement or I forget the other term, as I'm here on the hot seat, so to speak, the conditions of confinement versus the episodic act case distinction. If you look at the episodic act cases, or I mean the conditions of confinement cases that this circuit has found, the Dallas County Jail being the example, 50% of the patients in the jail or some huge percentage like that weren't getting their medication according to the pharmacist. This is one instance of one issue potentially. It's not, doesn't meet that standard of something pervasive throughout the jail. And the second case that I'd point out to is there's a series of cases out of the Wichita County Jail, Brown versus Callahan and Brown versus Bolin, where at least in Brown versus Bolin, the issue in part was whether it was an episodic act or not. And it was, admittedly, it was one act there of a nurse making a decision not to call the doctor that this court found to be not deliberate indifference for the sheriff, the county, and the doctor. But my point is that court found that that sort of singular individual screw up by a person was an episodic act and not a condition of confinement. So the theory that a couple of screw ups by people amounts to a condition of confinement just isn't really supported by the case law in this circuit or anything that seems to meet that standard.
They do cite some testimony that the visual log problem was more pervasive and wasn't episodic. You remember that quote?
Mm-hmm. Again, it would just be the conditions of confinement cases are something that affects everybody. We don't have
that
enough.
That doesn't pertain to Dr. Ford, though, right?
I agree.
I mean, his only liability would be in connection with state law negligence as an employee of the state, right? Misuse of a.
Well, he's an independent contractor, so.
Okay, so it's just regular negligence or malpractice.
And
or deliberate indifference.
Correct. And as Judge Higginson said, it's just a battle of experts case in the medical malpractice part. And
what's your position, and you may have double positions, as to Ford on the 1983 matter? Is it that they've waived that issue at this point?
That's one of my positions, is that they've waived it. They've not mentioned it today. They didn't mention Dr. Ford in their brief, at least with what he's mentioned as being part of some committee. But they don't argue that Ford is liable for the committee's acts. And that wasn't mentioned in the trial court. And then what they mentioned in the trial court was that he was committed medical malpractice with deliberate indifference, the kind of standard for a doctor jail case. That argument in the trial court didn't make it into their brief. So to me, it's a complete waiver. But I think on the deliberate indifference issue, the evidence that they cite to in the trial court for deliberate indifference is racing heart and chest pain, and the evidence at summary judgment and through trial was nobody ever made him aware of those things. And so he didn't know that she was having a problem to want to take corrective action. Then there's the low potassium from the hospital, and Dr. Dr. Ford, again, although he ordered the records, was never made aware of the low potassium. And then it's the combining the QT lengthening medications, Risperidol and Melorel. And he said, look, the issue came up in the medical literature, and so I went to the Travis County, whoever it was, he forgot whether it was the medical society or the library or whatever, and ordered all the medical journal articles he could find on the subject and read them all and made a conclusion that it was not as big a risk as people thought. And so now it comes down to a patient who has tried a series of drugs in the past and stops taking them, which is why she keeps having interactions with law enforcement and the state hospital and things like that. And so he's trying to come up with a treatment plan to come up with something that will work for her, and he weighs the risks and benefits and adds it on. And even their own expert, Dr. Ray, said he weighed the risks and benefits. That's not deliberate indifference to it. That's trying to make a judgment call about what's the best thing to do for this patient. And as you get to
his testimony was he was aware of the contraindication, but it also was his judgment that she might not take the later generation drugs?
She wasn't. The evidence was that she wasn't. She'd stopped taking her medication. That's why she had the psychotic breakdown that led to her arrest.
So he makes the determination that the third antipsychotic drug
maybe
in on the assumption that she won't be taking the other two?
No. That it's he's going to transition her to these other drugs. He starts her on the regimen that she was on the past. Uh-huh. To try to help get her under control. As Dr. Penn said, he found her, Dr. Ford still found her labile, meaning she's still had some rocking back and forth. He adds on the other medication with his thought process being, I'm going to ramp that up and phase out the others over the next week or so or however long she's in the jail to try to find something that will actually be useful to her to help her get through the psychotic
How could
problem.
They keep custody of her for all that time?
Pardon?
I say, was she a legitimate pretrial detainee for all that time?
She had a probation violation and no good home residence issues. I would say she was probably going to be a pretrial detainee for a while. She got a 15-day custody detention issue for her outrageous behavior at the beginning of the jail session. So I would, we're not talking about he's planning to treat her for months and months. He's just trying to get her started on the process to wherever she ends up, whether it's back in the state system, like MHMR, or back somewhere else. He's just trying to come up with a solution for her that will help with a long-term issue. And the fact that the MedMal trial was lost is really fatal to the claims against Dr. Ford because they're the exact same things. And that's back to they didn't prove that his negligence was approximate cause of her injury, and the claim, at least of the civil rights violation for him, was his negligence with the mental state of deliberate indifference approximately caused her death. And so the only thing that would be different would be the question of deliberate indifference, at least from Dr. Ford's perspective. That's just not proven. And so with that, unless there are other questions, I'll reserve my time to the county where there might be more questions.
I guess there aren't. Thank you. And now Ms. Craver.
May it please the court. My name is Ms. Craver and Elaine Casas, and I represent appellee Travis County in this case. We're here to ask the court to uphold the jury verdict in this case, as well as to affirm the dismissal of the 1983 claims on our motion for summary judgment. There are two aspects of this case, the trial issues and the summary judgment, and as the standard of review is de novo for the summary judgment, I'm going to address those issues. Of course, Travis County contends that the district court properly ruled dismissing the 1983 claims at the summary judgment stage because appellants failed to show a genuine issue of material fact concerning municipal liability under 1983. Appellants would have had to show a policymaker whose official policy was the moving force behind a violation of a constitutional right. And those elements were not met in this case. The appellants have contended that Diana Gonzalez, a pharmacist, was the official policymaker, but this is not a fact question to go to the jury. The Supreme Court has stated who is an official policymaker is a question of state law for the court to decide. And in this case, under Texas law, Texas Local Government Code 351.041 states that the sheriff of each county is the keeper of the county jail. The factual evidence in this case did not support an allegation that Sheriff Hamilton, the Travis County Sheriff, had delegated any authority as an official policymaker to Diana Gonzalez, the pharmacist. Sheriff Hamilton's affidavit stated so, as well as Diana Gonzalez's own testimony at her deposition. She stated she had not been given policymaking authority for Travis County. Unfortunately, she named the pharmacy manual policies and procedures, but just
what else are they? I mean, from the standpoint of the jailers, what are they? Ideas?
They are medical.
Turning the Ten Commandments into the Ten Suggestions?
Travis County's contention is that they are medical treatment decisions, determining the minutia of how a pharmacist operates, considering the drug formulary and certain advice to or guidelines to pharmacy techs in the daily operations of the pharmacy, but not official policy for the jail. As Estelle V. Gamble states, just because they're medical treatment decisions, that does not subject a county to municipal liability.
Give me an example of the policies that are applying to this case.
The policies that were attached to the motion for summary judgment include Sheriff Hamilton's promulgating rules that provide for medical care for the inmates. The sheriff employed a full-time physician, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, registered nurses. He also provided licensed psychiatrists that the county contracted with to provide care for the mentally ill population in our jail. There was also the provision of sick calls and immediate service for medical complaints by inmates. In this one case, which is the only case that the appellants have discussed for a customer practice, there are two issues of Ms. Jackson complaining of a medical complaint. The chest is hurting and her felt like her heart was racing. And in one of those two situations, the officer properly notified medical, called a registered nurse in the middle of the night, and documented in the post log that that nurse arrived and checked the blood pressure of Rachel Jackson. So that proceeded exactly as it should have according to the policies and trainings of the jail. The provision of medical care is the overarching policy and goal of the county. The minutia of the details and how that's formulated is up to some medical discretion, but certainly the fact that the pharmacist has discretion and the ability to make decisions does not make her an official policymaker in this case.
Would the every 30 minutes be a policy?
That was actually a written policy that was submitted as part of our motion for summary judgment, and it was an obvious departure from policy, the two individual officers who violated that policy. Contrary to what appellants have suggested, there was discipline for that violation.
Okay. That I hadn't read at that depth. So there was a concession that there was a violation and they were disciplined. It wasn't clear to me whether they actually had looked as they checked that they had, but they just hadn't sufficiently checked the body. You're saying that you think that they checked but never looked at all?
No, I think there is a possibility that they checked. It's the middle of the night, and of course the policy states that you need to find a living, breathing body, but it was at somewhere between 3 and 5 in the morning, and the problem is that they obviously, and in one case, an officer actually said she checked and had touched the body, where it was a sustained finding that she had not done so.
Okay.
And again, there was discipline both in Thomas Lynch. One officer received a written reprimand in his employee disciplinary file, and the other officer, who had actually resigned prior to the termination of the IA investigation, it was recommended when a finding was sustained against her, a violation of policy, it was recommended that she was ineligible for rehire should she ever want to return. So those were definitely departures from policy. And that is, I think, the crux of the issues at this summary judgment, is that 1983 liability for a municipality cannot depend on respondeat superior. So we have isolated instances of an individual officer or a nurse who maybe made some negligent or perhaps errors in judgment, and then two officers who were found to have actually violated policy. But it doesn't create a liability for the municipality because there was not a widespread custom so pervasive in this case that you could attribute it to the official policymaker, the sheriff, in this case. Further, there's just not unconstitutional action. As the court has noticed, we may have issues concerning medical malpractice or negligence, but certainly the case law is clear that a medical malpractice case does not become a constitutional violation merely because the patient is an inmate incarcerated. And lastly, in terms of the moving force issue, the causation was extremely attenuated in this case. And the medical examiner's report listed the manner of death as natural. He also testified in his deposition that it was a nebulous cause of death and that he could not rule out other possible causes, such as a grapefruit-sized cyst that interfered with her amygdala. There were a history of seizures in this case for Rachel Jackson. There was also a lengthy history of schizophrenia and treatment by drugs for that, as well as her own illicit drug use. I want to also say, just to clear up a few facts, it's Travis County's contention that she was not a pretrial detainee. She was arrested and probably would have remained for some time because she was in on a motion to adjudicate guilt for a probation that she was failing to keep up with. And she had already pled no contest to the crime of the felony drug charges when they put her on probation. So although the court had not found her guilty, she had pled to the actual felony in this case, which I think distinguishes herself from a pretrial detainee, just for the court's analysis on that matter. Further, in terms of the checks every 30 minutes, it's very speculative. It's terribly unfortunate that policy was not conformed with, but it's a speculative assumption that we could have saved her given that her death occurred somewhere within the 30-minute checks that were required by policy on Travis County's part. And lastly, although appellants contend that the standard is different for summary judge.
I don't quite understand what you're saying, what you just said. They obviously didn't check her for quite a while.
Right. And the policy mandated.
It takes hours to develop rigor mortis, doesn't it?
Yes, and I'm not disputing that. But the county's policy was to check every 30 minutes. So even had the policy been complied with in this case, it wouldn't have indicated that we would have been able to save Ms. Jackson's life. It would be somewhere in a 30-minute period. And again, it's unfortunate that there's not a causation even for negligence. The jury could not find at trial that the alleged negligence of Travis County caused Ms. Jackson's death. And certainly the standard of deliberate indifference and the 1983 violations are a higher burden for a plaintiff. In this case, Travis County contends that there were no unusual rulings at trial and that the summary judgment rulings were correct, and we're asking this court to affirm the lower court's rulings.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Weber, you have opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I just have 3 points. One is a factual issue. Travis County has argued that things happened exactly as they should have when Rachel Jackson complained of a racing heart and someone went and took her blood pressure. The problem is that she was denied medical care by that nurse and another nurse who knew about her complaint because they didn't put that in her medical records. They didn't relay that to Dr. Ford, who the very next day made the decision to put her on this other QTC affecting drug. So I assert that is, and in fact, that was against Travis County's own policy that vitals were to be documented and told to medical. So that did not happen exactly as it should have. Regarding both of the appellees' argument that the facts in this case regarding the persistent widespread practice of denying medical care are only regarding this one case, that's true, but this isn't the way that Dr. Ford's attorney characterized it, a singular individual screw up. This is multiple screw ups over the course of 5 days by at least 13, 14 if you don't consider the pharmacist in charge to be an official, 14 different Travis County employees. So I would distinguish this case from Peterson v. Fort Worth, where this court found that there was no consistent pattern, because there were 27 complaints of excessive force over the course of 4 years in a large city that had 67,000 incidents of crime a year. Here, it's true that we are limited to the facts of this case, but the facts of this case show a persistent, widespread custom of denying medical care. And, you know, especially when you limit the data set to this one jail, to this, the employees of this one jail, and the fact that over the course of 5 days, she was denied medical care by numerous employees. My final point that I want to address is the moving force argument that Travis County made. And again, the evidence on summary judgment is unequivocal. There was a dispute regarding whether or not the policies and customs of Travis County were the moving force, and not of her death, that doesn't have to be shown, but of her her rights being violated, that she was denied medical care. And you know, for instance, if Travis County didn't have an official policy of not warning healthcare providers regarding the effects of this severe drug interaction that was going on, perhaps, quite possibly, the staff at Travis County would have followed its own policies, the ways that they had been trained, and would have, for instance, reacted in the serious way that they should have when she complained that her chest was hurting. If there are no further questions, I'll end there.
Okay, we appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.